So it's triplets then?
No, no, it's just one newborn boy.
Oh, good lord, man.
It's one newborn.
I come from a family where every other birth
You've
is
You've never
multiple.
Taken care of any babies. No one will let you near a child.
I am...
I might start the podcast here. I might actually use this as the intro.
I'm a godfather to 18 children.
Wait, did you say you are the father to 18 children? I
refuse
to believe.
No, godfather.
Oh, well, okay, that's...
I regularly babysit babies.
Yes, Natalie.
Hippo, what would you like me to talk about so I can just get a mental heads up?
So, my sort of general plan today is just all four of the podcast hosts to get together. I introduce Marigi as the sort of Sea Control America host in waiting, as we sort of gradually sort of move over to some more control on his part, and you guys just talk about whatever you plan to do in the next coming year with the podcast and what you're up to now and how life is, and generally engage in friendly banter and what have you for about 30 to 45 minutes.
Okay.
That sounds lovely to everyone.
Sounds good to me. I'll do as much banter without using the word fecal matter as I possibly can.
Well, okay. No one said you had to do that, but okay, I guess it's a goal to move forward.
I have to stake out my territory as the not quite as offensive Matt as, you know.
I'm a very inoffensive podcast host.
That is true. You behave yourself on air and in front of your in-laws, but that's pretty much it.
Okay, so.
Oh.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so depending on where.
He behaves himself on air. Seriously?
Hey, listen. All right, Alex, don't make me come over there.
Not an absolute statement.
All right, so because I've made the executive decision that I'm pretty sure most of this conversation will be included in the opening to the podcast, I'll just let everyone know what it is we're doing here. And then leave the little pause for my wife's shameless advertisement for SimSec that I badgered her.
Seriously,
she's not here. She's not here. Don't worry. You don't have to apologize to her. I'm not irritating her right now. But you know,
I'm make sure she knows when she listens to it, she could do better.
Oh well, she can't now.
Thing is, Alex's thing loading. Damn it.
Well, that's okay. You don't really want to see his face. I mean, it's better. It's better this way. Alright, so everybody listening.
I'm sure Matt can't see me at the moment either.
I've been blinded. I just assumed that my body was rejecting your image. Alright, so everyone listening to this podcast wondering what the hell is going on, if we haven't explained it earlier, you know, depending on where I cut this thing. So you are here with the four hosts of the Sea Control podcast. We have Natalie Samby here.
G'day.
Hello. And she is our host in Australia, and then we have Alex Douglas Clark, who is our UK host. Say hello, Alex.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing?
Wow, if only you could bring that energy to your normal podcast, but, you know, we'll work on that. And then we have Matt Marigi.
Keep being rude, you're going to do them yourself.
Well, listen, okay, no one has to know your island, your little island exists, all right? That's why I gave you this opportunity, but, you know, you can throw that all away. And we have now, for the...
So rude, so rude.
For the...
Remember the White House. We're the reason it's white.
Well, okay. I mean, unless you guys are going to have a new accomplishment, I guess you can always lean on that one.
We don't really need to do it anymore. We did that.
It's old hat. We also have Matt Marigi, so you may have heard him before from the Thucydides Trap.
Yep, Toshi Yoshihara from the Naval War College, and also a guest lecturer or guest professor over at the Fletcher School.
And of course, it's me, your usual host, Matthew Hipple, president of the Center for International Maritime Security. The purpose of today's podcast is to kind of go over what everybody's doing, what's going on in people's lives, fun, friendly banter, and where they plan on going with the podcast. So for those of you who don't know, come around December timeframe, I'm going to be experimenting with my first opportunity to fail as a father and be digging myself out of mounds of diapers and of my incredibly irritating, irritated, not irritating, wow, that was not a Freudian slip, irritated and underslept wife, who will be having to feed him all the time, and then, of course, waking me up to do the same. So I figure that someone is going to have to take up the reins. So,
you just had to get fecal matter into it, didn't you?
Well, I'm trying. I'm going to try my best not to get fecal matter into anything, but I'm told that babies don't make that an option. So the plan in the coming year is...
haven't changed the diaper till you've had the pee go straight in your nose.
Listen, okay, you may be a godfather to, what is it, 38 children, but you're not 18. A real one yet. Okay, that doesn't count, okay? But anyway.
Yeah, that's the whole point of being godfather rather than father. You can hand them back and run for the hills.
Anyways, so the point of today's podcast is to give you that general sense of where we're going, and so you can kind of get a vibe as well for Matt Reggie, who, as time goes on, will be taking over the reins as the Sea Control America podcast host, and as, of course, our flagship here at SimSec.
Getting himself, you know, in advance of this little operation.
Exactly. So I'm going to give a quick pause here, like we're not already deep into the podcast, for a short word from my wife. Look, I haven't had a lot of sleep, right? I'm stumbling all over myself today. And we'll be right back.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back with Natalie's snide looks at me as I stumble over myself in Skype. Anyways, all right, so Matt and Marigi, why don't we start with you? The audience has heard a lot from Alex and Natalie throughout the Sea Control administration here. So tell them who you are, where you're from, and just kind of remind them, since it's been a little while since we've pumped out the Thucydides trap.
Well, thanks, and thanks again for, you know, tapping me to help take over for the America's edition of Sea Control. You know, I've been following the podcast for a long time, been heavily involved in SimSec for a while, so this is a great opportunity. I'm really looking forward to it. For everyone that doesn't know me already, my name is Matt Marigi. Currently the director of publications for SimSec. I was the membership secretary last year, occasional contributor to the Lessons from History series on SimSec's Next War blog, which I desperately need to revive because I really love that that column. But I've also, in the past, I was a country director and an executive officer in the U.S. Air Force's Office of Security Cooperation, the Agency for International Affairs. So I have a background working as a civilian inside of our Department of Defense, but I am currently in my second out of 2 years at the Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy, doing my Master of Arts in Law and Diplomacy, mostly focusing on security and Pacific Asia. So I've gone back to school, but most likely at the end of next year, I'll be spinning back into the public sector and continuing to write and working for SimSec. So that's a little bit about my background as far as what I've done before. But what I'm really interested in doing, you know, as I take over some more SimSec at Sea Control podcasts, is looping in the great resources I have up at Fletcher and, you know, bringing in some university professors to give some more of the academic style kind of expositions on the forward-thinking issues in maritime security. So I've got a couple people lined up so far, still have to get them scheduled, but Professor Sung-Yun Lee, who's one of the U.S.'s best experts on Korean Peninsula affairs. He's going to be coming in with me at some point in the next few weeks. I've got a couple people from the private sector, including Rockford Whites, who goes by Rocky, who is the proud co-starter of the group Cargometrics, for anybody that's familiar with that company and what it's doing for private sector maritime intelligence. So I've got a little bit of the entrepreneurial and the private sector perspective. And I also have a lot of people currently in the Navy and recently retired from the Navy, students of mine, students with me at Fletcher. So I'm going to be doing some panel discussions on sort of a young people's views on maritime security, both from people inside the Navy, but also those that have just left it. So it's going to be a broad kind of overarching, you know, sort of sampling of some of the resources I have up there. I've also still have some contacts left in DOD, and whichever ones are willing, if they're listening right now, to come on the podcast, I'd be more than happy to have you.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I would like to note, if Professor Robert Farley is listening, or Tony Carr, you'll note that one of the many signs of the collapse of the Air Force is they let this man be an executive officer of any kind. Navy's the best. And Air Force sucks. Anyways, except for Dave Blair. Dave Blair, a lovely regular here on the podcast. And Rich, okay, you two guys are cool. And Tony Carr. Okay, so maybe the Air Force doesn't suck so much. But anyways, yeah, that's the reason that Marighi is kind of taking this banner run forward with it, is he's in a target-rich environment. He's done this podcast before, and he's shown himself pretty capable, and he does have a very solid professional academic background, and he's not boring either. You know, I will admit, at least he has that much going for him. So it should be a good time.
I appreciate that glowing assessment.
Absolutely. Listen, that's going to be the best you're going to get from me, so enjoy it. But, you know, we are also here with Alex and Natalie, so either one of you can go.
Ladies first.
Oh, look at that.
I'm always the gentleman.
To balance me out, right?
I have to. It takes effort, but there has to be some balance in the world.
All right.
All right, get on stage.
Yeah, go ahead, Natalie.
Hi, everyone. Just wanted to say a warm welcome because I've been away for a while.
Yeah,
I've just gotten
for that.
Back. Come back with loads more experience. I've just been in China, and I've been in Europe, and I spent a little bit of time in the Middle East, which is all rather interesting, and came back to find that my country has a new leader, which, for those who don't know, we have a Westminster-style system, which means the political parties can elect a new leader, and the voting public just picks the party. So most people might find that a surprise, but we've churned through a couple of prime ministers in the last few years, as an understatement. So our new prime minister is Malcolm Turnbull, who came from the private sector, was our communications minister, and there might be a few changes in our foreign policy and defense policy. It'll be subtle changes, but I think we'll probably take the foot off the gas when it comes to our previous prime minister's very strong rhetorical statements on Islamic State. And hopefully, from my perspective, more productive relationships with our near region in Southeast Asia and Indonesia. The other big change is that in the defense realm, the push for the Japanese build of our new submarine might be a bit modified. It looks like the French and German bids might be a bit more competitive. So watch this space. I'll probably have a few podcasts in 2016 that'll explore the future of Australian defense capability, particularly maritime capability. Other than that, I've also become the branch president of the Australian Institute of International Affairs in Canberra, so I'll be able to rope in a few more of our guests as speakers for SIMSEC. And in 2016, I'll be looking to branch out more and having guests from India, from Malaysia, from Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, hopefully to grow our audiences there and to actually have a little bit more balance, a little bit more of a global view in our SIMSEC community. And lastly, I guess the only other thing that's noteworthy from our neck of the woods is we have our first female defense minister, Maurice Pine. So wait to see how she goes. And, yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. And Malcolm Turnbull is also a really sweet name to have as a prime minister. Like that, he sounds like he's from a TV show.
He's suave. He's good value. So we'll see how that goes. And if anyone's got a spot of time, there is a nice website called Tweets from Malcolm, which is almost rivalrous to Tweets from Hillary.
Oh, God. Well, on that point, we go over to someone who also has some new leadership in his country that everyone's really excited about. How are you doing, Alex?
Oh, no. Please don't make me talk about the Labour Party.
Please
I so
do. No.
We have the second largest left-wing party, theoretically, in our country, has just elected for its leader someone who is anti-NATO, pro-Russia, anti-Trident, pro-Iran, and so many things.
Meat is also opposite. The equivalent of smoking now, correct?
Just don't go there. It's just amazing how they've managed to do it. And he's got guys in his cabinet, and I do emphasize guys because he's so short of women in there, who are very, very pro the IRA. So pretty much he's managing to screw himself strategically and defense wise. And I'm going to use that phrase because I feel it's more polite than the other one I could use.
It's basically Russell Brand turned into some sort of political institution.
Actually, Russell Brand might have been better. And that's something quite big coming through, because at least Russell you can laugh at. This guy insists on being one of the most... Yes, he's better than Ed Miliband as a communicator, but that's because he's so boring and staid that he never puts a step wrong. And if the best you can say about someone is they're better than Ed Miliband was, who of course came up with a huge piece of sandstone to show his priorities for office, I'm not sure if the bar is really being set high enough.
And I thought Australian politics was a circus. Jeez.
You have no idea till you've seen this man. Jeremy Corbyn is, I am sure, a very earnest man who very sincerely believes what he says. The trouble is what he says and logic are not the same thing. I will admit I am a Conservative Party local councillor where I come from, so I am, of course, biased. But I'm trying to be as academic and as polite about him as I possibly can. And that is about the limit I can get to before I start making comments about the fact that he will sing the red flag but not God Save the Queen.
Well, okay. Now that everyone has a taste for the character that is Alex Clark, is there anything you'd like to add? Because I feel like you've done a great exposition on just your general vibe and perspective on life.
Well, I think I should get into podcasts. We certainly have our second Strategic Defense and Security Review starting. It is so up in the air and so disorganized that no one will actually do a panel with it on me at the moment. So that's why we're concentrating on putting out the Falklands podcast, which is a great series, and we'll
absolutely
have more people. Basically, the SDSR ranges from some person who I think was possibly a member of one particular service having the dreams that the other two services were going to be entirely cut and they were going to be in existence. If I said actually it wasn't one of the Navy people I was talking to, it was actually one of the Army guys, I think he may have been doing something which you were earlier alluding to, Matt, in terms of what he was smoking. There are all sorts of rumors flying around. The principal issues for maritime sphere and naval sphere are the fate of the River Class, the Type 26, and I suppose the F-35B, but frankly that seems to be more connected with the exchange rate of dollar to pound and how many of them we can actually afford, and whether or not we actually want them in the end. But leaving that to one side, because of course we always have the option of the Eurofighter, which still apparently can't drop its bombs after how many years in service. But I will not get onto RAF bashing, because that will make me sound anti-RAF, and I'm not anti-RAF. I just find the whole concept of bringing an aircraft into service which can't drop a bomb when it's one of its primary duties, because it hasn't been doing any air defense missions other than intercepting Russian bombers occasionally when they turn up, is to be able to, of course, drop bombs, but it can't do that yet. But leave that to one side, that small... It's kind of like we've got a whole generation of escorts which haven't got any land attack capability other than their gun. it just seems to me the Ministry of Defence, British Ministry of Defence, can design something which is a brilliant thing, and then they will send a cost engineer along who will say, well, actually, we can save 15% if we just delete the hangar from the amphibious ships. Oh, and at the same time, we'll lose the entire medical deck and some extra accommodation and command space and the gym. Because, of course, you need none of those things in an amphibious operation.
Well,
hey-ho.
Yeah, aircraft and people and physical fit. That's kind of...
So we now have a whole generation of amphibious ships, which the Royal Navy has fitted with temporary hangars because they weren't built with them.
A little lovely tent city for aircraft on the top.
Yes, literally, they've got tents on their back.
So how's Falklands round two looking for you guys?
Well, thank God the Argentinians are even less funded than we are.
Well, you know, there's always that. So
yeah,
that's
the advantage at the moment. That's the one thing we're sticking to. Hopefully they won't get any funding before the Queens get involved, and hopefully at some point, the idea, which keeps being a concept discussed but hasn't yet been fermented, of the ocean replacements, which would be one to two LHDs, and hopefully not replace Albion Bulwark, will come into service, and we'll then have four flight decks we can operate off, and F-35Bs will be able to go from all of them, and so will be the airborne early warning aircraft, and four large docks. So then we should be able to use an amphibious brigade and should be able to guarantee an organic air support. Fingers crossed and the good Lord providing. That's always necessary. But whether we have the escorts to protect them will depend, of course, on whether the government procures the 13 they wanted to in SDSR 2010, the 17 recommended by the House of Commons Defence Select Committee, or the 24, which seems to be the common number coming from most of the independent authorities.
Wow. Okay. Well, now it's very clear to everyone why you are allowed to have a podcast, because you're like a tiny... pudgy bearded encyclopedia.
Don't call me pudgy. I'm going to the gym twice a week.
That's true. No, Alex has lost. Ladies, Alex has lost a lot of weight. He's looking trim and fit, and he knows about the Falklands. So what else could you possibly ask for? And you know what? In all seriousness, though, I do really think that in the full sense of the word, that the Falklands series that we have had the pleasure to host here at SimSec is absolutely a feather in our cap. I mean, it's a gem, truly. And I mean that wholeheartedly, without any sarcasm that I usually use in Alex's general direction.
Sarcasm is always returned in the light banter.
Of course, absolutely, in true British fashion.
Tell Martha if she's ever in the UK, I know tons of guys who she'd really like.
Well, I have the distinct advantage that my wife and I are Catholic, so that means that we play for keeps. So she's trapped. She's stuck with me, which means
I know an archbishop who'll annul it on grounds of incompetence.
Okay, we can't use. Okay, again, I said Catholic. I didn't say Henry VIII chop people's
heads off. Catholic archbishop. I went to a Catholic university. One of the priests who was there as a lecturer is now an archbishop.
I'm slightly concerned that maybe we're getting back to what Luther's major problems were. If you can throw a few dollars towards one of your archbishop friends and get a marriage annulled.
Who said anything about dollars? I was talking about a bottle of scotch.
Oh, God. God, even worse. No! So this is what happens when the Pope is over in the United States, is you guys start running wild over there.
Oh yeah, and us Protestants still rule all the way.
Oh, you know what? This is a podcast on military affairs and foreign policy. I don't think that we need to re-argue the schism here today. That's probably not the forum for it. All right. Well, with all of that formality and whatever the hell that was out of the way, does anybody kind of let's just kind of talk about what's going on right now? I mean, from the South China Sea to Iran, Russia, and Syria getting together into some sort of hellish triumvirate of intelligence and operational kind of coordination. Kind of what's everybody's bag right now? Like, what are you looking at? What are you concerned about? And what are you thinking about?
Well, I'm enjoying the Chinese conquest by civil engineering.
That's true.
It worked so well with their, great wall.
building artificial islands in the South China Sea? Hey?
I wonder if we could just start dredging them. Like, if they want to be passive-aggressive like that, we start building our own island. You, like, get a mile away from their island, we start building it, and we build it until we're up on their island.
These islands are massive. They have entire airfields, and we're talking very, very long runways that very, very big aircraft can take off and land on.
Yeah, I'm kind of really got my fingers crossed for a typhoon to take care of this. Because if they're just building all this stuff on top of sand, I'm thinking maybe a really
bad weather
pattern might
take it. This is where coming from a family of engineers makes me worried, because I can see the sheer quantities of concrete they're pouring into those islands. They ain't going nowhere.
But it's still built on top of sand, though. I mean, I'm not a civil engineer, you know, but it still seems like you just dredge enough sand. I mean, what was it? Is it the airport in it's the Osaka sinking airport. You know, Japanese engineers built that thing to the nines, and it's still sinking into the seabed.
Yes, but they picked a fault line zone, and very specifically, the Chinese, of course, picked to build on reefs, which are rocky outcrops anyway, where the rock has bulged up from the Earth's crust. So these are places where there is actually, if you go deep enough, stable stuff to build from. And you can guarantee the Chinese are very good at long term. They will have gone deep enough.
All right, Natalie, now that we have let Alex, take his piece of this pie, and also steal one of your major topics, because, you know, he's not like our UK correspondent or anything talking about South China Sea. What's
here,
on your
I
mind
just have
right
to
now?
Talk about migration.
Oh, be quiet. You be quiet, all right? You had your time in the sun, Pax Britannica. Now Natalie gets to go. But okay, what is on your mind right now?
I mean, of course, the China building, you know, the land reclamation in the South China Sea is something that's become a bit of a perennial issue for us. And I actually just wanted to put it on the table between you guys. I think sometimes I've seen some criticisms on some fora that Australia isn't taking a hard enough stance on this particular case. Firstly, do you guys think that's the case? That Australia ought to be more...
Australia can do. You're in the wrong position to do much about it. You know, you can try as much as you can get involved. You've got to be there supporting other allies. And the trouble is, you have your own things you need to be doing and need to be defending.
Well, I mean, that was just what I was going to explain. I mean, that Australia is a bit more of a unique case. It's not simply that what we see is that China misbehaving and sort of flaunting international rules and being aggressive towards Southeast Asian actors. We also have a very deep economic relationship with China. We're also located in this region. And so things that happen in the Asia Pacific have a lot more immediacy for us, and especially where they may impact our Southeast Asian partners. So it's a bit more of a treacherous area for us, I suppose. And make no mistake, I have faith that policymakers and diplomats are making the right kinds of noises behind closed doors, even if we may not have the strong kind of rhetoric that some of our partners may want us to have in public fora. That setting that aside, the other kinds of issues when we see the Asia Pacific, I mentioned earlier Islamic State, foreign fighters is a concern for us, both, you know, those coming out of Australia and those, you know, who are potentially in the region. I saw some news the other day that Malaysia is an area of concern for Indonesia as a source country for foreign fighters coming from Malaysia to go into Indonesia. These are all things that we think about, because we have had a history of concern about terrorism in the region. And, you know, we had a prime minister who was very attuned to these kinds of problems. And I'm trying to think what else that we've got there. Those are the two things I would sort of highlight for now, the sort of more pronounced things. I mean, as Alex said earlier, with the defense statements coming out of the UK, we're meant to have a white paper that was due in August and then in September and then October to outline our strategic vision. I'm not exactly sure where that's at, but it perhaps could come out later in the year. I'm not expecting that white paper to deviate terribly much from the kinds of strategic pronouncements that we've made since our last one, but it would be nice to sort of have and to give a little bit more clarity to where we stand. But, as things go by, I'm just trying to think what other sort of issues that we've got. I think those are the major ones for now. I'll loop back and link in with a couple of things you guys will talk about in a second.
Well, question, you know, I do have a question for you. And you talked a little bit about Malcolm Turnbull at the beginning. And two questions. One, okay, how long is he going to last? Because, you know, you guys have got a pretty high cyclic rate down there on national leadership. And two, you suggested that there would be a change in the nature of Australia's relationship with its regional partners and allies in Southeast Asia. And you don't have to go into specifics, and I imagine it's a topic that you'll bring up in later podcasts, but maybe you can kind of give a general sense on what that you estimate that relationship to be now and where you see that relationship going.
Okay, the first thing I need to highlight is that Australia's electoral cycle is 3 years. And as you can imagine, that's not a very long time for a government to get settled in, for a cabinet to get settled in, to get across the books, to start developing policy, implementing policy, and then begin campaigning for the next time around. So Tony Abbott has been in for 2 years now, I think. And so there isn't a lot much more time till another election.
But isn't that why there's shadow cabinets? And correct, maybe I'm helping the American audience here. But okay, it takes a little while. But when another party turns over, isn't there's some shadow on the other side that's at least kind of developing those kind of policies and strategies already, as if they were already in power? Am I wrong in thinking that, or just not work that way?
I can't speak for Natalie, but in Britain's experience with a shadow cabinet, be it just because you have the shadow cabinet post doesn't mean you're necessarily going to end up in that post once the party's elected.
Oh, well, that's kind of useless.
You're often, there's a complete reshuffle.
Yeah, there's that too. I mean, I was going to say just because a shadow government is, not within government, a shadow cabinet, just because they're not within government doesn't mean that they're developing good policy per se. I think, Matthew, you're being really optimistic there in suggesting that because they're in waiting, that they're there crafting the best policies possible other than sniping at the current government from the sidelines. I think cabinets and shadow cabinets and governments are concentrating on politicking and good policy, you know, God bless them if they can get there, is something that's a bit trickier. Well, Malcolm Turnbull's got possibly 12 months, well, depending on when they call an election, to get settled in and get some policies on the board. So we'll have to see what happens. He's relatively popular. Some commentators were just suggesting perhaps we should have left Tony Abbott in and a Labor government might have had a better chance of getting elected. So I think it's a little bit early to tell whether or not Turnbull should last in the next election, but there are questions as to whether or not the current coalition government will win the next election. I'll just put that out there. In terms of Turnbull foreign policy and Turnbull defence policy, again, I would caveat that with early days, but some of the early statements that have been made, not only by Turnbull, but by Maurice Payne, the new defence minister, have suggested a reinvigorated relationship, a better relationship with Indonesia in particular. I haven't seen too many other statements about relationships with countries like the United States or Japan, although I would imagine Australia would continue to enjoy a good relationship with its only ally. When it comes to Indonesia, our previous Prime Minister had some very strong border protection policies and utilised very, very strong rhetoric that tended to alienate the Indonesian public and then sort of positioned their more nationalist president to kind of react in such a way to stand up for Indonesian sovereignty and to see and he by nature is a little bit more guarded about their national issues. I would expect and I would hope that Turnbull would be a little bit more conciliatory when it came to Indonesian domestic affairs before passing judgment and making comment. He seems to be quite a good and measured operator, so I would hope that relationship continued to be quite cordial and productive going out to the next election.
All right.
It is interesting to listen to the fact, the effect of the 3 year cycle that the Australians have versus us with our now 5 year fixed term parliaments, which means quite a lot of stability really in that we know who's going to be, the SDSR is conducted within the first year they're elected, as it was in 2010, it's been inducted in 2015, and then they have 4 years where they're going to be implementing it before the next election. So it's really, it does bring a certain level of stability to defence. and to security issues in that you know who you're going to be dealing with.
Hmm. Hopefully. So I'm trying
as long
to decide
as the Prime
whether or not
doesn't reshuffle too often.
So I don't know if our four year system here in the United States puts us in the perfect best of both worlds or the worst of both worlds. You know, we'll see. We have our own elections coming up, so we'll see what happens there. But I'm sure they'll be huge. They'll be the classiest elections you've ever seen. Not
so
to channel any particular
Trump
candidate.
Clinton?
No!
Too soon.
Not too soon, man.
I don't think
it reveals, I think it would reveal no political predilections on anyone's part if they reacted with revulsion to that kind of race. It's like, there's all sorts of stuff for everybody to hate.
I'm hoping it's Trump and Palin and the Republican ticket. I think that would be really interesting.
I have no comment. Moving on to Matt Moringi. Moringi, you there?
Yeah, sorry. Occasionally the connection keeps cutting in and out. My apologies.
That's a nice excuse for not paying attention to any of us. We had a real fun conversation, so welcome back to it.
I was enjoying it very much. I didn't want to interrupt all the smart people that were talking, so I figured I would just let that go. I was actually curious, Natalie, as far as Aussie Prime Minister's interactions with Indonesia, how much of that has been changed by Jokowi's election? Has that really been a non-factor in terms of the ways that people have been approaching Indonesia?
It's definitely a factor. I think there are a whole bunch of factors in the bilateral relationship that are out of the control of leaders. So, for instance, the spying allegations that happened in 2013 was this kind of like intervening event where no one foresee that, the revelation of that in the public sphere. And that necessarily caused a rupture in the relationship. There was no choice but the Indonesian president to, choose to have a hard stance on that. That's fine. Having said that, the president that we enjoyed in Indonesia for that decade, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, was very optimistic about the bilateral relationship and went to great lengths to try and construct, a productive and a cordial relationship. He spoke in the Australian Parliament a couple of years ago and really talked about wanting to bridge a lot of the gaps and asked for understanding and for empathy on both halves and asked for the media in both countries. And you couldn't really ask for a more favorable leadership in that regard. And in certain instances tried to play down some of the diplomatic crises that we had. So Jokowi's election does bring in a new character of leadership in Indonesia, and he is, quote, focused on different things. SBY was focused more about promoting Indonesia's reputation by means of presence in international fora, about looking active, Indonesian peacekeeping, that kind of stuff. Jokowi is oriented much more to the domestic sphere and carries with him a much more of a sense of guarding the Indonesian people, providing for the underdog, looking after welfare much more generally, and does have this sense of wanting to be much more heightened towards sovereignty and territorial issues. And so when he speaks, when he talks about, for instance, when there was an execution of two Australian drug traffickers earlier this year, about Indonesia being able to exercise its own laws within its own boundaries, he really means that, and he really means to sort of stick it to the Australians as if to say, look, this is our own country. This is how we're going to do things. And I think to some degree that's fair. But also when it comes to guarding Indonesian waters against illegal fisher people, he has this policy of destroying illegal fishing vessels that are caught. Those fishing vessels are perfectly fine boats that could be given to his own people or could be utilized or you could take the parts of or whatever. No. The Jokowi government's policy is not only to destroy these boats, to blow them up in a spectacular fashion, but to publicize it and to hold those particular events on National Day, occasions. And so there's a sort of sense of theater to this. So his way of handling particular security issues and the way in which they intersect with foreign relations is a very different character to the way in which SBY, who was there, again, I emphasize, for a decade, of handling Indonesia's security and defense issues, but also how he then balanced good foreign relations, not only with Australia, but, countries in ASEAN and other partners. So, yeah, I think the Indonesian president matters. And in this particular instance, having Jokowi, who was very nationalistic, gutted about sovereignty, Tony Abbott with, a very conservative border protection policy, there were always going to be inevitable clashes. And, you know, obviously over our Navy's policy to tow back boats into Indonesian waters was one example of that. We shall see whether or not that border protection policy evolves under Malcolm Turnbull. But I think so long as Jokowi is there, we have to just be a little bit more careful and to accept that those nationalistic type statements will be coming out of that country for a while longer.
One thing I'd like to say, I have to say, when I heard about the blowing up of the boats and first heard mm-hmm. about it, what went through my mind was that he was trying to prevent the Chinese doing a tit for tat, taking them back, because the Chinese probably mm-hmm. are the nation he worries about most for this, and probably was worried about them if they were given to his own people, and then the Chinese might, their coast guard might come and take them back, and it might turn into a whole tit for tat thing. Whereas if he destroys them, it makes it a public statement, and it also pushes it immediately beyond that level at which China can do it without looking bad.
Yeah. Yeah, look, there's...
Go ahead, Matt.
Go ahead, Matt. You're the smart one on this.
I said Matt, so you were okay, but I like how you thought I said Nat. Because I figured you'd have a question that Nat could answer, but then, okay, whatever. I'm just going to take a step back. You guys, whoever wants to talk.
Murray, you go for it, and I'll respond to Alex in a sec.
Okay, well, I was curious then, you know, if Jokowi is destroying the boats, then, and obviously that, you know, that makes it difficult for the Chinese to take them back, but then does that raise the question of escalation? Because it's not like it's all, I know the Chinese for the most part are, you know, the most flagrant offenders as far as who's doing illegal fishing, but they're not the only part of the equation. So does that mean that the Coast Guard then is going to respond in a tit for tat manner with destruction as opposed to with receiving?
But isn't that something that they already do? I mean, the Chinese Navy is, I'm sorry, the Chinese Coast Guard or whatever, you know, sort of unit they send out there has made an explicit point of ramming other ships, of destroying ships, of using very explicit, I mean, they're not explicit like, hey, on national TV, I'm going to blow a ship up. But to a certain point, I mean, the implementation of violence is the Chinese policy in the South China Sea.
And the Philippines.
I think that's true, certainly with some countries, but I would like to clarify that isn't the case necessarily with Indonesia. You know, China has a very different relationship with Indonesia than it has with the Philippines and Vietnam, for instance. I would highlight that there have been confrontations between Chinese Coast Guard vessels and Indonesian Coast Guard vessels out in the seas or around the Natuna Islands, and that's been written about before, and that's sort of involved more electronic warfare and jamming of communications as the sort of high level of that confrontation. And as Matthew pointed out, it's not just the Chinese who are conducting illegal fishing in the area. It's also the Thai, the Malaysians, the Philippines, the Taiwanese, the Japanese, and so on and so forth. So there's a whole range of actors that this policy, this boat blowing up policy, is directed to. And yes, it's a statement about deterrence, and it's a statement about national pride. There's the theater aspect of it. Yes, it is also about destroying the boats so they don't get reused and recaptured, but I think it's less likely about that, as it's more about the deterrent policy. As Alex's question about the concern of those boats returning into Chinese hands, yes, if that policy were applied uniformly. So looking since Jokowi was elected and this policy was ramped up, so I'll just highlight that this policy existed before, but it's only been very highly publicized since November last year. So if you look at the number of boats that have been blown up since Jokowi has come along, most of them have come from Southeast Asian nations and only one or two from China that have been destroyed. Actually, up till only a couple of months ago, no Chinese boats have been destroyed. So I had some questions as to whether or not that policy was being applied evenly. And the only major Chinese boat that's been blown up was one that was actually detained several years ago. And it wasn't, you know, it doesn't reflect the number of Chinese boats that have been detained, which the Maritime Affairs Ministry has said that's because they're getting processed, it takes some time, so on and so forth. I say it doesn't appear that the policy is being applied evenly, but I wait to see what happens in the future. What also happens is that Chinese boats get detained, and people don't get charged. The people who are occupying, you know, who are manning the ship, and the companies, the Chinese companies that are sponsoring those ships, there are some, how do I put this? some things that happen up the chain, and some messages that come from above that means that these cases don't get prosecuted. And then that causes complications for illegal fishing that continues in future. That's how I'm going to put it. So that there are some unsavory practices, and I'll just say it, some corrupt practices that occur that hamper the extent to which illegal fishing is clamped down on Indonesia. So the boat burning policy, the boat blowing up policy is one thing. There are complications on the other. It would be interesting to see whether or not this policy were applied much more evenly in future. But I don't think it's – wait to see whether or not it's having the appropriate deterrent effect. That's really hard to measure.
So, guys, we are butting up against the stops on our sort of hour-long limit here for this podcast. And I know that Alex needs his 3 hours of sleep before he goes back to stumping.
No, I don't have to be – I'm fine. I'm up at 4 a.m. tomorrow, so I can go on to 1 a.m. quite happily.
Well, I'm not going to force that issue. And so
I like 3 hours of sleep. That for me is just a lot of sleep.
Listen, that's a lifestyle choice.
That's more than I normally need.
I don't think listeners need to know about the ins and outs of Alex's sleeping habits.
You know, I think that Alex's complete lack of sleep does explain a lot, though.
Oh, fair enough.
But anyways, so Matt,
exactly
I will
the amount of work I managed to get done.
That's true. Matt, too, I will leave it to you to sort of illustrate whatever it is that is the major issue you are thinking about today, and then the four of us will close up with any final thoughts or plugs, and then be on our way. So, Matt Marighi, what is the major maritime security IR / whatever issue it is that you are pondering at the moment?
Well, I didn't want to keep it too much on the, you know, East Asia or the, you know, yeah, the East Asia theme of the day. But definitely the, passing and the changing and reinterpretation of, Japan's use of force abroad, last week on, I guess was, on Monday last week, where they finally passed the new ruling that, Japan will be able to use its, forces outside of its, territory for, you know, much more easily. As long as it's, of course, you know, stipulated that it's supporting coalition operations and allies, and there's these big, you know, kind of frameworks that, you know, that in theory are supposed to limit what it is that they'll be able to use force for. But in reality, if you look at the actual criteria, it's very, very broad in terms of what, you know, what can be classified as something warrants a shipping. The thing I've been interested most in is, one, what are the implications for the region on it, which everyone's been following, but two, also the way that the Japanese government has been kind of prosecuting the public relations campaign, because on the one hand, they've been doing the standard, you know, government announcements and, you know, PR and that kind of work, but on the other side, they've also been sending a lot of Japanese, you know, policy experts, both military, civilian, a lot of people actually outside of government. I mean, they've been sending them around, at least in the United States, doing essentially a PR campaign where the Japanese government is funding people to you know, express their views about what the legislation changes mean. But the interesting part about that is it's also not based off of government talking points. It's a very broad sort of engaging, you know, at least in the United States, in this sort of public discussion on what this can mean and what this should mean. So I'm very interested to see, you know, now that we've gotten kind of a week through, you know, some of the initial furor has died down in East Asia, particularly with China and Korea, and I'll be interested to see kind of how the chips fall, you know, on this. Also, for as far as personal interest goes, I'm writing my thesis on this, so that's the other reason why I'm following this as closely as I am.
Remember that you do have the option to cite your own podcasts, I think, if you interview the right people. So you can ask exactly the questions you need for your paper, and then voila, there you go.
Go to a website called Cite Them Right, and they'll tell you completely how to cite them correctly for your particular referencing style, whether it's Harvard, Chicago, whatever.
Fabulous.
Perfect.
Good referencing.
That's exactly what I need.
So, Alex, all right, we will start with you, go to Matt, and then finish with Nat, and let everyone kind of give their closing thoughts or plug anything that they've got coming up or think is of interest. So, Alex, go ahead.
Well, I would take an interest, and I've just watched this pop on my Twitter feed, a couple of things. The party, which, of course, has elected Jeremy Corbyn as its leader, Labour, have just had a vote, and they decided they're going to still support Trident,
which is good for the Conservatives and good for implementing Trident procurement. But I have a feeling, rather like the Scottish referendum, this could turn into a neverendum if no one's careful.
Sure,
so, yeah, I'm sure it will be coming up again shortly. My main thing, which I'd like to put across, is that defence debate needs to be widened. And that is one of the problems we have in the UK and in Europe in specifically, is that the defence debate keeps trying to be pushed down to just the experts arguing instead of the wider public. And it's always better, any debate is better, when you get more people putting their ideas in and more fermentation. Personally, today I've had a paper published on European geostrategy, which is looking at a future strategy for Britain and how it can be better able to adapt and influence events in the world and in Europe. So I'd love people to go and have a look for that. I also have a paper which is due to come out on British naval history at some point, which is about Soviet naval diplomacy and how that developed from the 1950s onwards and why they preferred to use cruisers rather than aircraft carriers, which I found very interesting myself, and I thought could have some lessons for us today. Other than that, there is the next Falklands War podcast, which is coming out, which is going to be Sharky Ward. As soon as I've now better, not ill, I'm going to edit it and put it together and Perfect. Send it away.
You know what, Alex? I do like the fact that you have these two papers, and yet you chose your topic instead of making it one of those. You decided to set Natalie up for more discussion on Asia. So you're very kind. You're very kind. And also scatterbrained. I don't know which one is more evident in your actions, but now that you've
met... My students would say it's because I teach so many of them.
Oh, look at that, humble brag. But I do expect, then, that perhaps you should consider two executive summaries of your potential papers with links for SimSec. Yes, good idea. Awesome, great.
Okay, yes.
Very excited to have them. Now, let's move on to Mr. Marighi. Any closing thoughts or plugs you want to make?
Well, I think in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be writing a follow-up piece to one of my pieces on Next War from about a year or two ago about RPA and armed drone exports. It'll be coming up soon. There was an article that came out a couple of weeks ago about the Pakistani army testing its first armed drone, which, of course, it got from the Chinese because of that close technology relationship. And it's sort of the follow-on from what that first article I wrote a couple of years ago was talking about, which is we're, I think, entering a phase now of armed drone proliferation that is going to spread way faster than the United States was originally, conceiving of before. You know, for a long time, the U.S. government's been using the Missile Technology Control Regime, the MTCR, and sort of the fact that the U.S. had kind of a dominant role in armed RPAs from Afghanistan and Iraq, as a way to sort of limit the proliferation of these kind of technologies. But it seems like the Pandora's box is open. It's starting to proliferate. And the question now is who else is going to get these, and what is that going to mean for how the U.S. responds to use of force around the globe. So it'll be very interesting. I'm hopefully going to get that done in a couple of weeks. You know, schoolwork and notwithstanding. But that'll be sort of the next thing that I'm going to be coming out with.
Yeah, it's always exciting when you get to see a bunch of authoritarian ne'er-do-wells get together and start developing advanced, deadly technology. It always gives you, a nice, warm, fuzzy about where we're going. And, of course, go ahead.
Imagine what is the U.S. government's reaction going to be when China starts dropping munitions, or when the first one starts dropping things, perhaps it digitizes them. There's a lot of interesting areas that this could really cause in terms of being able to respond to uses of force when the U.S. has been so liberal in using it in the past. So it's going to be, the Chinese person, they live in interesting times. It's going to be very interesting.
And, of course, saving the very best for last, Natalie, please close us out.
All right, coming up for me, I'm flying to India next week to give a paper on female engagement teams at a conference on law enforcement and women. I also have a paper coming out in light of the discussion we had earlier about maritime issues in Indonesia on Jokowi's Global Maritime Access Vision. That will be coming out in the journal called Security Challenges, which is available online, and I'll be able to send that out by the SimSec account when that's published. Coming up in my SimSec repertoire, I have an interview with Tim Huxley, who's over at the Institute for International and Strategic Studies in Singapore, and we'll be talking a little bit about Singapore at age 50, where the Singapore Armed Forces are heading, and a little bit about Southeast Asian regional security. And lastly, for those of you who don't know, I've also joined Blogging Heads as a host, so I'll be over there talking more about foreign policy and international security issues, and also giving a plug to our SimSec crew. And it's good to talk to all of my fellow SimSec hosts today.
Yeah, this is, I mean, thank with you. The exception of Alex, this has been an absolutely lovely time to discuss with all of you.
Please pass on the note to Martha. I have no.
You know what? I'll let her know. But like I said, she feels contractually obligated to live with her mistake. So, I'm in luck.
That's the way you're keeping her with you, by contractual obligations.
Yeah, well, Matthew Hipple is the master of bureaucratic obfuscation and keeping people to do things that he wants.
Through a procedural technicality, I've saved my marriage.
When he was at wedding classes, you know, that was just cruel, some of the ideas.
They made us pick little rocks, and they said, ooh, how do you want to do your work-life balance? And one's like vacation, one is, hey, you know, hobbies. And so when Martha wasn't looking, I just picked five rocks that all said work.
That doesn't surprise me.
And apparently when the Catholic Church has a booklet on, you know, defining things like love and how arguments work when you're in a marriage, when you start applying IR theory, people get really uncomfortable.
Yeah, they would. Probably listen, very accurate application of international relations theory, because it is two constant negotiations between two nations, but
two belligerent
yes.
parties, yeah. The I have someone at work who told me that marriage is when you find someone that you want to irritate for the rest of your life. So I have found that.
Hopefully
in
doesn't mind being irritated by you that much.
Well, we're going to have, like I said, we're going to have a son now, so we'll have someone who loves us enough to irritate both of us at the same time. So it'll be a learning experience. Well, everyone, as for me, I'll just put another plug out, if I haven't already, for the Real Time Strategy podcast. So along with our fine policy, history, and news work here at Sea Control, we will be advancing into a discussion of simulation. So board games, video games, sort of pop culture, past, present, and future. When it comes to simulating and engaging with human decision making is a really awful and complicated way of saying dudes playing video games, as a way of sort of how do we learn about policy and strategy, how do we avoid learning about policy and strategy from these kinds of simulations, because you can do both. There's great lessons to learn, and there's lessons that you should definitely avoid or be aware that you are being mistaught. When
tell me when you get onto the discussion of the Total War series.
Oh, don't.
I'd really enjoy that one.
I'm sure. Listen, I just recorded it earlier, about an hour before we sat down for this one, and two of the guys, it was Adam Elkis and Brett Perry, ended up discussing EVE Online for about 30 minutes. So I'm hoping we don't lose our audience from day one, but. You know, it's an experiment. We'll see where it goes.
Also, Supreme Commander, the first version, was very good.
You know what, Alex? I think we've found another host. Marigi's going to be on with this. If some of you guys haven't heard of Crispin Burke, I've reached out to him. He plays Total War 2. So, okay, we got some more players for this little get-together. Natalie, are you interested in joining a bunch of socially underdeveloped individuals talking about video games?
Well, with this SimSec podcast, I'm almost there.
that's how lovely. Lovely for you.
And you thought it was only me who was going to be slamming
listen,
you today.
Okay, I can't. Listen, she is well aware. She is well aware of my rules of engagement and knows that she's safely outside of the firing zone. So, okay. Well, and Natalie.
Whereas
Natalie,
me, you just failed to land any of the shots.
You, okay. Listen, that's for the audience to decide, Alex. All right. Well, I'm going to stop, using excellently everyone's time here. And, well, we'll, We'll talk to y'all next week. Bye, everyone.
Take
care. Been a pleasure. Looking forward to working with you guys.
Bye.
Good job. All right. I think that was pretty excellent.
So much messages.
Oh my God. What's that, Natalie?
I was like, oh my God, the poor listeners.